Welcome to Lindy Upgrade Studio. Our TOEFL reading podcast helps you build the background knowledge, academic vocabulary, and useful expressions behind real TOEFL reading passages. So whether you're out for a run, at the gym, on your commute, or doing chores around the house, pop in your earbuds and let English sink in naturally.
Imagine for a second walking into a hospital clinic because you're suffering from, you know, terrible chronic back pain. You sit down, the doctor looks over your chart, and, well, instead of writing you a prescription for some heavy painkillers, they write a prescription for a specific Mozart symphony. And they tell you to play it twice a day at a very precise volume.
Wait, like an actual medical prescription for a song?
An actual prescription. Or, I mean, think about being a student who is completely overwhelmed by a huge exam coming up. The doctor doesn't give you a stimulant to fix your brain fog. Instead, the clinical intervention they recommend is a highly specific, curated playlist.
Okay, that sounds like something straight out of a sci-fi novel.
Yeah.
Or, you know, maybe some fringe alternative medicine clinic out in the woods somewhere.
Right. It does sound a bit out there, but it's actually the reality of modern clinical science. Mm-hmm. And more importantly for you listening right now, it happens to be the exact focus of the text we're tearing apart in today's deep dive. We're looking at Article 05 in our curriculum titled The Power of Music.
Which is honestly a brilliant transition from where we left off. I mean, in our previous deep dive on Article 04, we explored the human microbiome, right? We spent all that time looking entirely inward at these microscopic ecosystems inside our digestive tracts.
Yeah, looking at how the stuff inside us keeps us healthy.
Exactly. But today, we're flipping that completely upside down. We're looking at an external, invisible force, sound waves. We're examining how those physical vibrations in the air actually enter the ear and fundamentally alter our internal biology, our cognitive processing, and, well, even our social structures.
It's fascinating. But, you know, as someone who has guided a lot of students through these standardized tests, I have to point out a massive psychological trap right at the top here.
Oh, it's a Spotify mindset trap.
Yes, that is a perfect term for it. And it is exactly the reaction the examiners are hoping to trigger when you sit down in that stressful testing room.
Right, because you see a title like The Power of Music flash on the screen.
Yeah.
And your brain just instantly relaxes. You're like, oh, thank goodness. It's not a dense passage about tectonic plates or, I don't know, 18th century farming tools. It's about music. I listen to Spotify for 6 hours a day. I go to concerts. I know exactly how this works. So this is going to be super easy.
And that relaxed familiarity is the trap. The TOEFL examiners are incredibly strategic. They know that when you encounter a familiar everyday topic, you tend to stop reading strictly.
You just start skimming.
Exactly. You skim. You start relying on your own life experiences to answer the multiple choice questions instead of relying on the strict logical architecture of the academic text in front of you. But the reality is, academic texts do not treat music like a fun workout playlist. They examine it through a highly elevated, multidisciplinary lens.
Yeah, the passage we're looking at today bridges biology, sociology, and clinical psychology all at once. It uses C1-level vocabulary to build these really complex cause-and-effect arguments. And if you just rely on how your favorite pop song makes you feel, you will confidently choose the wrong answers.
You absolutely will. So our mission today is to completely demystify this dense 150-word academic text.
We're going to break down the complex arguments, right? And tear apart the Latin roots of this high-level vocabulary so you literally never forget them. Plus, we'll look at exactly how test makers use these concepts to build distractor traps.
So let's dive right into the opening claims the author makes. Before an academic writer gets into the microscopic details.
Which this author definitely does later on.
Oh, big time. But first, they have to establish their broad thesis. They have to tell the reader the overall scope of the argument in paragraph one.
And the scope here is massive. The author asserts that music is not just entertainment, but an active force that influences three distinct domains of human life: our emotional state, our physical behavior, and our biological health.
Right, the trifecta.
Yeah. The text specifically claims that listening to music can reduce stress, alleviate pain, and improve cognitive function. And it wraps up this whole introductory argument by stating that music therapy has become an integral part of treatment for various conditions.
There is just an incredible amount of dense academic language packed into those opening claims. So let's isolate that first major C1 level verb you mentioned, alleviate. The text claims that music can alleviate pain. If you're taking the TOEFL, you absolutely must know exactly what this word means and maybe more importantly, what it does not mean.
Let's break down the mechanics of the word itself. Alleviate. It just feels very formal, you know, almost heavy to say.
It does feel formal, but its linguistic roots are entirely about lightness, actually, if we look at the morphology.
The physical structure of the word.
Right. We can unlock a permanent memory hook. Alleviate is built from a combination of Latin pieces. The prefix is a variation of ad, which means to or toward. But the core root of the word is the Latin term levis, L-E-V-I-S. In Latin, levis means light.
Just to clarify for everyone listening, we aren't talking about light like the sun or a light bulb, right? We're talking about weight.
Precisely. Light as in the opposite of heavy. Light like a feather. The Romans used levies to describe things that lacked physical weight or burdens that were easy to carry. Now think about how that ancient root has trickled down into the B1 and B2 English words you already use every single day.
Oh, I see it immediately. An elevator.
Yes. Think about the fundamental purpose of an elevator. You're carrying heavy grocery bags, you're exhausted, and you need to get up to the 10th floor. The elevator does the heavy lifting for you. It lifts you up. It makes the physical burden of gravity lighter.
That makes total sense. Or even the word levitate, like a magician performing a trick, making an object float in the air. The object defies gravity, right? It loses its heaviness. It becomes light. Or a lever in physics, which is a tool you use to lift a really heavy object with way less effort.
Exactly. So when we return to our academic text and the author states that music can alleviate pain, we don't have to guess at the meaning. To alleviate is to take a heavy burden, which in this case is physical suffering, and make it lighter. It's the process of reducing the severity of a negative condition.
So let's talk about how test makers build multiple choice questions around this specific word. Because understanding the definition is really only half the battle. You have to know how it functions in a sentence under pressure.
Right. Let's do a mock question.
Okay. Imagine a classic TOEFL vocabulary question. The word alleviate in paragraph one is closest in meaning to, and the options might be A, eradicate, B, tolerate, C, diminish, or D, elevate.
This is a brilliant distractor trap. Let's look at option A first, eradicate. I can easily see a student thinking, well, if music is good for pain, it gets rid of the pain. Eradicate means to destroy completely, so A must be the answer.
It's such a logical jump if you're rushing.
It is, and that is exactly the logic the test maker is preying upon. But let's go back to our root, Levi's. Making something lighter does not mean making it disappear completely. If I help you carry a heavy sofa up the stairs, I am alleviating your burden. But the sofa still exists. You still have to do some of the work.
Right. The pain doesn't just vanish.
Exactly. If a doctor gives you medicine to alleviate your symptoms, you are still sick, but the suffering is less severe. Eradicate means to wipe out completely, like curing a disease forever. That is just far too strong of a synonym for alleviate.
Okay, so eradicate is out. What about option B, tolerate?
To tolerate means to put up with something unpleasant without trying to change it at all, like you might tolerate a noisy neighbor. But the text is arguing that music actively changes the pain. It doesn't just help you ignore it or put up with it, so tolerate is incorrect.
That leaves us with C, diminish, and D, elevate. Let's look at elevate, because this is the trap I see students fall into the most when the clock is ticking. Alleviate and elevate look incredibly similar on the page, and honestly, they sound almost identical to an English learner rushing through a reading section.
It is a devastatingly common trap, and it's so dangerous because the meanings are practically opposites in this context. If you elevate something, you are raising it up, you're increasing it. So if a text says music elevates pain, it means the music is making the pain worse. You're turning up the volume on the suffering.
So how does a student sitting in a silent testing room, heart pounding, quickly differentiate between those two identical sounding words?
I give my students a phonetic memory trick for this. When you see the word alleviate, I want you to focus on the soft, open, ah sound at the very beginning. Ah, alleviate. It sounds like a sigh of relief. Imagine sitting down in a comfortable chair after a long, exhausting day. Ah, relief. Alleviate brings relief.
Ah, alleviate. I love that. It forces you to connect the physical sound of the word to the feeling of a burden lifting.
Yes. And for elevate, focus on the hard A sound at the beginning. Elevate, like an elevator. An elevator goes up. If you elevate pain, the pain is going up, which is obviously a terrible outcome for a patient. So returning to our mock question, the only logical answer is C, diminish, which means to make something smaller or less intense.
You know, you really see the word alleviate pop up everywhere in academic texts, way beyond just medical reading.
Oh, absolutely.
Like if you're reading an economics passage, you will constantly see the collocation alleviate poverty. The government passes a law to alleviate poverty, meaning they aren't curing it overnight, but they are making the financial burden lighter for the citizens. Or in an environmental science passage, you'll see alleviate traffic congestion or alleviate water shortages. It's a foundational C1 verb.
It absolutely is. And the author immediately follows it up with another heavyweight academic term. The text claims that music not only alleviates pain, but it also improves cognitive function.
Cognitive. Mm-hmm. C-O-G-N-I-T-I-V-E. Let's unpack the linguistic history of this one because it unlocks a whole family of useful words.
The anchor here is the Latin root cognoscere. In ancient Rome, to cognoscere was to know, to learn, or to recognize. It was all about the internal process of acquiring knowledge.
You can actually hear the English word recognize hiding right inside of it.
Exactly. Let's break recognize apart. The prefix re means, again, like replay or rewrite. And cognize comes from that root for knowing. So to recognize someone on the street simply means to know them again. Your brain had the information stored and you retrieved it.
What about the word incognito? Like when you open an incognito browsing window on your computer so it doesn't save your history, or a celebrity travels incognito wearing a hat and sunglasses.
Same exact root. The prefix in acts as a negative, meaning not. So to be incognito literally translates to not known or unrecognized. You're hiding your identity from being known.
That is fascinating. So when we take that root back to the phrase in our passage, cognitive function, what exactly is the author referring to? How do we translate that into conversational B1 or B2 English?
Right. If we want to be informal, we could just say brain power. But in a clinical or academic setting, cognitive function refers to the specific mental processes that allow you to interact with the world. It encompasses things like your working memory, your ability to focus, your spatial awareness, and your problem-solving skills. So if you're doing a complex math equation, you are heavily relying on your cognitive function.
So the claim the author is making here is actually incredibly bold. They aren't just saying music makes you feel happy. They're claiming that listening to music actually acts like a software upgrade for your brain. It improves your processing speed, it makes your memory sharper, and your problem solving more efficient.
Yes. And because of these profound physical and mental effects, the author reaches their concluding point for this first paragraph. They state, "It is no surprise that music therapy has become an integral part of treatment for various conditions."
I want to put a massive spotlight on that phrase, integral part, I-N-T-E-G-R-A-L. That is a hallmark academic collocation. You really cannot read a university-level textbook without tripping over the phrase, an integral part of.
It's ubiquitous. And again, understanding the root gives you total mastery over the concept, so you don't have to just memorize it blindly. Integral shares its DNA with the mathematical term integer.
Right. An integer being a whole number, like 1, 2, or 3, not a fraction, like 1/2 or 3/4. An integer is complete.
Exactly. It represents wholeness. So if a component is described as integral to a system, it means that without that component, the system is no longer whole. It's fractured. It cannot function properly.
Let's draw a distinction here to really clarify this for our listeners. Let's use the analogy of baking a cake. If I'm making a chocolate cake, the flour is an integral part of the recipe. Because if I decide to skip the flour, I don't have a cake. I just have a puddle of wet eggs and cocoa powder sitting in a pan. The whole system collapses.
But what about the decorative frosting on top? Or the little colorful sprinkles?
All right, the frosting and sprinkles are supplementary. They're nice additions. They definitely make the cake better. But if I leave them out, I still have a fully functional whole cake. They are not integral. Or think about a car engine. The spark plugs are an integral part of the engine. If you remove them, the car simply will not start. The whole machine is useless. But the shiny red paint on the outside of the car? That's just cosmetic.
This is a vital distinction for understanding the author's argument. When the text says music therapy is an integral part of medical treatment, it is aggressively pushing back against that Spotify mindset we talked about. The author is saying that playing music in a hospital isn't just cosmetic. It isn't just the decorative frosting on the cake meant to make the waiting room feel less depressing.
Exactly. They are claiming it is the flower in the cake. It's the spark plug. It is a foundational, necessary component of the clinical treatment itself to make the patient whole again.
I think we need to introduce an overarching analogy here to really cement what this first paragraph has accomplished before we move on to the biological mechanisms in paragraph 2.
I completely agree. And I've actually been thinking about this. I want you, the listener, to picture a room in a house. Now imagine you buy a beautiful painting and hang it on the wall of that room. The painting is a decoration. It changes the mood of the room. It looks nice, but it does not physically alter the reality of the environment. The air in the room is exactly the same as it was before.
Okay, I follow you.
Now, instead of a painting, imagine you install a thermostat on the wall. A thermostat is not a decoration, it is an active regulator. When you adjust the dial on a thermostat, you trigger the mechanical systems of the house to physically change the temperature of the air. You make the environment hotter or colder. In the context of this academic passage, the room is your body. And the author is explicitly arguing that music is not a painting. It is not just decorative sound. Music is a thermostat.
That is a phenomenal way to conceptualize the passage. Music is a biological thermostat that actively regulates the temperature of your pain, your stress, and your cognitive sharpness.
But that begs an immediate question, doesn't it? If music is a thermostat, how is the house wired? What is the actual mechanism connecting the dial on the wall to the furnace down in the basement? How do invisible sound waves entering the ear turn into a physical painkiller inside the brain?
And that logical curiosity is exactly what drives the transition into the second paragraph of the text. Academic writers are highly logical architects. Paragraph 1 established what music does. Paragraph 2 is designed entirely to explain how it does it. We are moving from the broad claims into the microscopic brain chemistry.
The text asserts a very specific chain of events here. It says that music affects the brain by triggering the release of neurotransmitters, specifically naming dopamine and serotonin. It then notes that these specific chemicals are responsible for pleasure and mood regulation. Furthermore, it explains how the speed of the music alters this process, saying fast-paced music energizes the body, while slower tempos calm us down.
We have to unpack the verb that kicks off this entire biological chain reaction, triggering. Music affects the brain by triggering the release.
Trigger is one of those wonderfully versatile English words. I mean, in its most literal physical sense as a noun, a trigger is the small mechanical lever on a firearm. It's the part you pull with your finger to shoot the gun.
But in the realm of academic science and biology, we almost exclusively see it utilized as a verb. To trigger an event means to cause it to happen, but with a specific nuance. It implies a sudden, immediate initiation.
Right. Just like applying a tiny amount of pressure to a gun's trigger causes an immediate explosive reaction, triggering a biological process means you are flipping a switch that releases a sudden cascade of effects.
In TOEFL reading passages, you will encounter this verb constantly paired with very specific nouns. You might read an earth science passage about how an earthquake triggers a tsunami, or a biology text about how pollen triggers an allergic reaction, or an economics text about how a stock market crash triggers a recession.
So in our text, the music is the finger pulling the lever, and the sudden explosion that follows is the release of these complex chemicals. The text calls them neurotransmitters, N-E-U-R-O-T-R-A-N-S-M-I-T-T-E-R-S. This is a massive, intimidating word. I feel like if a B1 student sees this under a time limit, panic just sets in.
There is absolutely no need to panic if you know how to dissect the word. Let's operate on it. We can slice neurotransmitter into three distinct, easily digestible pieces. The first piece is the prefix neuro. Anytime you encounter neuro in the English language, your brain should immediately route you to the nervous system, the spine, and most importantly, the brain.
Like a neurologist is a doctor who studies the brain. A neurosurgeon operates on the brain. Neuroscience is the study of the brain. It's a very consistent prefix.
Exactly. So we know we're dealing with something inside the brain. Now let's look at the second piece, trans. This is a Latin prefix meaning across or beyond.
Think of a transatlantic flight. You are flying across the Atlantic Ocean. Or a transcontinental railroad, which stretches across the entire continent.
Or even the word translate. You're carrying the meaning of a word across the boundary from one language to another.
Perfect examples. And the final piece of the word is mitter or mitter, which is a Latin root meaning to send. We see this root hiding in words like submit, which means to send under authority, or emit, meaning to send out, like how a fire emits heat.
Okay, so if we stitch those three pieces back together, neuro, meaning brain, plus trans, meaning across, plus mitter, meaning to send, a neurotransmitter is literally something that sends things across the brain.
That is the exact biological reality. Human brain cells, or neurons, do not actually touch each other. There is a microscopic empty gap between them called a synapse. When an electrical signal needs to jump from one cell to the next to tell your body to do something, like move a muscle or feel an emotion, it can't cross that empty gap on its own. It needs a ferry. It needs a messenger. And the neurotransmitter is that chemical messenger. It carries the signal across the gap in the brain. That is brilliant. It perfectly aligns with the linguistic breakdown. And the text specifically names two of these chemical messengers, dopamine and serotonin.
This is a critical moment for a test-taking strategy. When you see specific medical or scientific terms like dopamine and serotonin on a reading test, you do not need to possess outside medical knowledge. You don't need a degree in pharmacology to pass. You only need to extract exactly what the author tells you about them.
And the author's very explicit here. They pair dopamine and serotonin directly with pleasure and mood regulation.
Right. And then they introduce the variables that control these chemicals. The author uses vocabulary related to the speed of music. They talk about how a song is paced and they use the word tempo.
Tempo is a fantastic word. It is literally the Italian word for time. But in global musical terminology, it refers exclusively to the speed or the pace of a piece of music. The author contrasts fast-paced music with slower tempos. And they attach specific descriptive adjectives to these speeds, calling them upbeat and soothing.
Let's define those clearly for our listeners. Upbeat originally referred to the unaccented upward stroke of a conductor's baton in music. But in modern conversational English, if we say a person is upbeat or a song is upbeat, it means they radiate positive, energetic, fast-moving optimism.
You play upbeat music at a party. You don't play it in a spa.
Exactly. Because in a spa, you want the exact opposite. You want soothing music. To soothe someone is to calm them down, to comfort them, to alleviate their anxiety. A mother sings a slow, soothing lullaby to a crying infant to bring their heart rate down so they can sleep.
Okay, let's tie all this biology and musical terminology together with an analogy, building on our earlier idea. If music is the thermostat regulating the body, then these neurotransmitters, dopamine and serotonin, are the actual heating and air conditioning units down in the basement. They are the heavy machinery doing the physical work to change the temperature.
I love this. And how does the tempo fit in?
The tempo is the physical dial on the wall. When you turn the dial up, when you play fast-paced, upbeat music, the thermostat sends a signal down to the basement. It triggers the heating unit. It releases a rush of dopamine, flooding your system with energy and pleasure.
And when you turn the dial down?
When you put on a slow, soothing playlist. The thermostat triggers a different system. It turns on the air conditioning. It releases serotonin, which cools the system down, regulating your mood and bringing your heart rate into a state of calm.
That is a flawless conceptualization of the paragraph's logic. But I want to throw a different analogy at you just to look at it from another angle. Let's imagine the brain is a massive logistics warehouse, like an Amazon shipping center.
Okay, I can picture that. Conveyor belts everywhere.
Exactly. The neurotransmitters are the fleet of delivery drivers. Their entire job is to pick up a package, which is a chemical signal, and deliver it across town to a specific address, which is another brain cell. Now, who controls the drivers?
The dispatcher sitting in the office.
Right. In this scenario, the music is the dispatcher. When an upbeat, fast tempo song comes on, the dispatcher grabs a microphone and yells, "Emergency rush order. We need maximum energy right now." They dispatch the dopamine drivers who sprint to their delivery trucks and flood the streets, delivering packages of high energy and pleasure to your muscles and nervous system.
When a slow, soothing tempo comes on, the dispatcher's voice gets quiet. They say, "All right, team, shift is ending. Let's calm things down." They dispatch the serotonin drivers who drive slowly, delivering packages of relaxation and mood regulation, telling the city to go to sleep.
Both the thermostat analogy and the delivery driver analogy work perfectly because they highlight the strict cause and effect logic that the author is building. The TOEFL examiners will relentlessly test your understanding of this sequential chain. Tempo acts as the trigger. The trigger causes the neurotransmitters to release. The neurotransmitters cross the gap, and then the physical state of the body changes.
I have to pause here, though, and push back on the broader implications of what we are discussing. Because I'm looking at this text and I'm realizing something profound. If the author is stating that music directly triggers the release of dopamine and serotonin, well, those are the exact same chemical neurotransmitters that are manipulated by heavy pharmaceutical drugs. Antidepressants manipulate serotonin. Stimulants manipulate dopamine. Is the author of this academic text fundamentally arguing that Spotify is basically a drug?
That is a very sharp observation, and yes, that is precisely the logical conclusion of the text. From a purely biological standpoint, the mechanism described here is identical to a pharmaceutical intervention. The brain's receptors do not necessarily know the difference between a surge of dopamine caused by swallowing a pill and a surge of dopamine caused by the auditory cortex processing a 120 beat per minute pop song. It is all neurochemistry.
That completely validates the claim from paragraph one. The author wasn't just using a metaphor when they said music therapy is an integral part of medical treatment. They were being literal. It is a non-invasive way to hack the brain's internal pharmacy.
Exactly. You are reading like a master test taker right now. You are connecting the thesis in paragraph one to the supporting evidence in paragraph two. The author made a bold medical claim and then immediately provided the microscopic biological proof to back it up.
It's a beautifully constructed argument, but the author doesn't stop there. Having proven the internal biology, they decide to zoom out, which brings us to the third and final paragraph of the passage. The sociological impact and, well, a very dark warning.
Let's trace this narrative shift. Paragraph two had us looking through a microscope at a single synaptic gap inside one person's head. Paragraph three asks a massive sociological question. What happens when you take thousands of these individual brains, all chemically reacting to sound, and you put them together in a public square?
The text shifts from biology to sociology. It argues that music is crucial in social interactions. It claims that shared music strengthens interpersonal bonds, creates a sense of profound unity, and can even influence massive social movements. The author provides a very specific example, noting how chanting and singing are utilized in protests and rallies to motivate and unify the participants.
Let's unpack the high-level vocabulary carrying these sociological concepts, beginning with the word crucial. The author states that music plays a crucial role.
C-R-U-C-I-A-L. I feel like this is a word we use constantly in everyday conversation without thinking about its true weight. Like, oh, it's crucial that I get coffee this morning.
We definitely overuse it. In an academic context, crucial is an absolute powerhouse of a word. It is vastly stronger than just important. It originates from the Latin root crux, C-R-U-X. A crux historically referred to a cross, or the exact center point where two roads intersected. It represented a fundamental turning point.
So if you are standing at a crux, the direction you choose changes everything that happens next.
Exactly. Therefore, if something is crucial, it means it is the decisive factor that determines the success or failure of the entire system. A crucial vote in parliament changes the law. A crucial mistake in surgery costs a life. So when the author claims music plays a crucial role in human social interaction, they are making an astronomical claim. They're suggesting that without music, human society and the way we bond would have evolved in a fundamentally different direction.
And one of the primary ways it plays this crucial role, according to the text, is its ability to unify people. Let's look at that verb, U-N-I-F-Y.
This one is very satisfying to break down because the prefix is so universally recognized. The prefix is uni,
which always means one. A unicycle is a bicycle with only one wheel. A unicorn is a mythological horse with exactly one horn. The universe is the entirety of everything existing as one single entity.
Right. And the suffix FY simply means to make or cause to become. You see it in words like purify, which means to make pure, or simplify, meaning to make simple.
So to unify literally translates to make into one.
Precisely. Let's apply this to the text's example of a protest or a massive rally. Imagine 80,000 people standing in a stadium. You have 80,000 individual brains, 80,000 different life experiences, different political views, different stress levels. They are a fractured, chaotic group of individuals.
But then a rhythm starts. Someone starts beating a drum or chanting a simple repetitive phrase.
And this goes back to the biology of paragraph two. That external sound wave enters 80,000 pairs of ears simultaneously. It acts as a biological trigger across the entire crowd at the exact same moment. It triggers a synchronized release of neurotransmitters. Suddenly, those 80,000 individual brains are chemically aligned. They're feeling the same dopamine rush at the exact same tempo.
They have been unified. The music literally made them into one single cohesive organism.
That is the immense power of shared sound. And I want to be incredibly careful here to honor our commitment to impartiality on this deep dive. When the text talks about protests and rallies, it does not specify what the people are protesting for or against. It doesn't matter if it's a left-wing political rally, a right-wing political rally, or just passionate fans chanting for a sports team.
Right. The text isn't interested in the politics at all. It is strictly analyzing the sociological mechanism. The shared acoustic rhythm is a tool used to forge a psychological bond and motivate the crowd, regardless of the cause they are gathered for.
Exactly. The author is highlighting the unifying power of the sound wave itself. But immediately after illustrating this beautiful unifying power, the author throws a major curveball at the reader.
They really do. The author issues a stark warning, a caveat. They write that despite these benefits, not all music has a positive impact. They warn that loud and aggressive music can actually increase stress and anxiety.
Let's dissect the word aggressive. It's another compound built from Latin. The prefix is ad, meaning toward. The root is gradi, which means to step.
To step toward.
But specifically, to step toward something in a hostile, uninvited, or attacking manner. If a dog is aggressive, it isn't waiting for you to come pet it. It is actively stepping toward you with its teeth bared.
So aggressive music is sound that feels like an assault. It feels like it is physically stepping into your personal space and attacking your auditory system. It is the absolute antithesis of the soothing music we defined earlier.
And because sound possesses this dual nature, where it can be a soothing medical treatment or an aggressive assault, the author concludes the entire passage with a call to action. They state that we must understand these profound effects so we can make informed choices.
Informed choices. That is our final C1 level academic collocation for this breakdown. An informed choice is a decision made only after gathering relevant data, understanding the facts, and analyzing the consequences. It is the exact opposite of an impulsive or blind guess.
If you walk onto a car lot, point at a shiny red sports car, and buy it immediately just because you like the color, that is an uninformed choice. If you spend 3 weeks reading consumer safety reports, analyzing the engine reliability, negotiating the price based on market value, and then you buy it, well, you have made an informed choice.
The author's ultimate argument is that most people treat music like the impulsive car buyer. They just turn on the radio without thinking. The author is pleading with the reader, saying, I have just shown you that music alters your brain chemistry and shapes your social reality. Mm-hmm. Stop treating it like background noise. Treat it with the respect of an informed decision. Okay, I need to zoom out again and look at the architecture of this text from the perspective of a test taker. Because there is something structurally bizarre happening here, and I want to push back on it.
Let's hear it.
The author spends 2 full paragraphs, and most of the 3rd paragraph, building a fortress of praise for music. Music is medicine. It alleviates pain. It improves cognition. It unifies humanity. It's amazing. And then literally at the finish line, in the final 2 sentences, they suddenly say, oh, but wait, aggressive music is actually bad and causes anxiety. Why do academic texts do this? Why ruin a perfectly positive, cohesive essay by throwing in negative warning at the very end that feels so disjointed?
What you are identifying right now is one of the most critical structural concepts you will ever encounter on the TOEFL. You have just identified a rhetorical device called a concession.
A concession, meaning to concede or surrender a point to the opposing side.
Precisely. You have to remember the primary goal of academic writing. An academic author is not a salesperson. They are not trying to sell you a flawless product. If an author writes an essay claiming that something is 100% perfect with absolutely zero negative side effects or limitations, what happens?
The reader stops trusting them. They sound like a biased cheerleader or a propagandist, not a careful scientist.
Exactly. An academic audience demands objectivity. To prove that they are objective, a skilled author will always include a concession. They will pause their main argument and acknowledge a limitation, an exception, or a valid counterargument by saying, hey, I acknowledge that music isn't a magical cure-all. In fact, aggressive music can be quite harmful. The author is proving to the reader that they have analyzed all the data, both good and bad.
Oh, wow. So pointing out a flaw in their own subject matter actually makes their overarching positive argument stronger because it establishes their credibility as a balanced researcher.
Yes, it builds immense trust. If they admit the truth about the harmful effects of aggressive music, you are much more likely to believe them when they claim that soothing music alleviates pain.
And I imagine the test makers aggressively target this specific structural pivot in the reading comprehension questions.
They love it. You are almost guaranteed to see an author's purpose question built around a concession. The question will look something like this. Why does the author mention loud and aggressive music in paragraph 3?
And let me guess the distractor trap. Option A will be something like, to prove that music is a dangerous force that should be regulated.
That is the exact trap. A student who only skimmed the last paragraph will read about stress and anxiety, panic, and select that option, completely ignoring the fact that the previous 90% of the essay praised music.
So what does the correct answer look like?
The correct answer will use verbs related to balance and limitation. It will say something like, to acknowledge a limitation of music's benefits, or to provide a balanced view of music's physiological effects, or even to concede that not all auditory stimuli yield positive outcomes. Recognizing the architectural function of a concession is the secret key to passing those high-level, logic-based TOEFL questions. You aren't just reading for facts. You are reading to understand the blueprint of the argument.
That is a total paradigm shift. It turns the reading section from a confusing scavenger hunt into a logical puzzle.
All right, we have excavated an immense amount of material from this short passage. Let's move into our comprehensive summary and vocabulary review. Before we close out this deep dive, we need to gather all these intricate puzzle pieces together and ensure you, the listener, have firmly grasped the material for your exam prep.
Let's start with a high-level summary of the passage's logical flow. The author built a very deliberate arc. Paragraph 1 gave us the broad, thesis-level benefits. It established the trifecta of influence, how music impacts the mind, the body, and behavior. It made the bold claim that music therapy is an integral medical treatment.
Then, the text seamlessly transitioned into paragraph 2 to provide the biological evidence. It zoomed in to explain the mechanism. It introduced us to the brain's delivery drivers, neurotransmitters like dopamine and serotonin, and explained how the tempo of the music acts as the dispatcher, triggering the release of those specific chemicals.
Finally, paragraph 3 zoomed back out to a macro-sociological level. It explained how shared musical rhythms create unity in massive crowds, physically syncing up thousands of brains. But it crucially ended with a concession, acknowledging the negative, stress-inducing realities of aggressive music to validate the author's objectivity, leaving us with an urgent plea to make informed choices.
That is a flawless summary of the architecture. Now, I want to lead an interactive vocabulary review. Listeners, I want you to actively participate here. Don't just listen passively. When we prompt you, try to vocalize the definition or remember the Latin root before we reveal the answer.
I'll serve up the target words and you provide the conceptual hint. Let's go. Word number 1, alleviate.
Think back to the Latin root levis and our analogy of the heavy bags in the elevator. Does to alleviate a situation mean to eradicate it completely, to make it worse, or to make it better? I'll give you a second. To alleviate means to make the burden lighter, to reduce the severity. Remember the sigh of relief. Alleviate.
Excellent. Word number 2, cognitive.
Think of the Latin root cognoscere and the English words recognize and incognito. What specific system in the body is cognitive function related to? It is entirely related to the brain. It encompasses knowing, learning, memory, and mental processing. It is your brain's processing power.
Word number 3, the intimidating compound word, neurotransmitter.
Break it into its 3 original pieces. Neuro, transmitter. What is the job of this chemical? It is a chemical messenger whose job is to carry signals across the empty synaptic gaps inside the brain. It is the delivery driver.
Word number 4. We have a contrasting pair here. Soothing versus aggressive.
Picture the 2 very different scenarios we discussed. A mother with a crying baby versus a snarling dog approaching you on the street. Soothing music brings comfort, lowers the heart rate, and induces calm. Aggressive music steps toward you with hostility, inducing stress and anxiety.
And our final vital academic term, unify.
Focus on the prefix uni. Think of a unicycle, a uniform, or the universe. When 80,000 people chant together in a stadium, what does the sound do to them? It brings many disparate individuals together to make them into one single cohesive group.
You know, applying this specific test strategy, learning to understand complex academic words through their foundational roots and affixes, is like walking into the testing center with a secret weapon. It means that even if the examiners try to trick you with a variation of these words, you are immune to the trap.
Exactly. If the test suddenly asks a difficult inference question about the alleviation of a patient's pain, or the cognition of a toddler, or the sudden unification of a divided political movement, you won't freeze. You won't be distracted by the unfamiliar suffix. You will instantly spot Levi's for light, cognoscere for knowing, and uni for one. You will cut right through the trap and find the core meaning.
That is the ultimate goal of what we do here. We want you sitting down at that computer feeling entirely empowered, understanding the architecture of the test, rather than feeling intimidated by it.
We have spent an incredible amount of time pulling apart a passage that was barely 150 words long. But look at the staggering amount of depth, history, and scientific mechanism hidden inside those few sentences. Music is a biological trigger. It is a social unifier. It is a scientifically validated medical treatment.
Which brings us to the end of our journey today. And as always, I know you have a final provocative thought you want to leave us with.
I do. I want to connect back to the author's final urgent plea about making informed choices. The text didn't just share fun facts. It proved that music is an aggressive chemical trigger. It physically alters your brain's pharmaceutical balance. It dictates your stress levels and your cognitive processing speed. So my challenge to you is this: how intentionally are you curating the soundtrack of your own life right now? When you sit down to study for the TOEFL, are your daily playlists actively alleviating your stress and boosting your cognitive focus? Or are you accidentally bombarding your auditory system with aggressive tempos that are secretly raising your cortisol and destroying your concentration? Remember the analogy. You are the dispatcher in your own brain. You have total control over the dial. You get to choose the tempo.
Wow, that fundamentally changes how I view my headphones. I really need to start treating my Spotify playlist like a pharmacy, dispensing the exact chemical I need for the task at hand.
Make an informed choice. It is crucial.
This episode was created by Lindy Upgrade Studio. Until next time, keep upgrading your English.